Yippee! Yippee! Yippee!
Listen, what's the title of this thing? No title again?
And I did not live the little
Is it rolling, Bob?
Yep. Good morning. Well, it is for me. It's Monday. Usually not a favorite day, but I just decided, hey, I got a 3-hour class and I'm giving them an exam, which is going to take them over 2 hours, 2.5. So that pretty well takes care of the class. Just have to photocopy it. The marking comes later. That's the ugly part. But anyway, that just sort of takes care of all I have to do today. Not so many meetings this week like I did last week. My wife is having some a minor procedure, and I guess I'm a little concerned about that, but I don't want to talk about it. But nothing serious. I shouldn't have even mentioned it. Erase that if I could. I'm in a new location. I mean, well, not a new location. Been here before, but the City Hall, Scarborough City Hall, now the Civic Center. The handicap parking spot is all full, so I am sitting in the park that faces it. I'm usually looking down on this spot, and here I am in it. It's sunny, the grass is green, it's actually quite a beautiful day. And I decided it was time to get this podcast going, number 343. And already I'm having some doubts. I sort of put off. I was in Bluffers Park, and that's usually where I just whip out the recorder and start, and I didn't have anything to say, and today I almost forced myself to say, okay, hey, it's time. Talk to them. You got stuff to get rid of. But on the way here, my iPod filled up with some new podcasts. Norm Augustinus, who I hadn't heard from for a while. We hadn't heard from, if you're a listener. And, of course, he's left the Meldorf Farm in Iowa, Dyke, Iowa, and is in New York City now. Talking about his lousy apartment and the woman deep-throating in the apartment next to him, etc. But I don't know that I was in the mood. It was a long episode, maybe an hour and 20 minutes, and I would need to give myself time to listen to that, to devote myself. So I switched over to Keith McNally's XO, and immediately, they're both artists, and Norm is more almost like a stage art. It's almost like you can picture a guy standing up giving you this monologue and making the noises, the sounds. It's different, and it's a story that he's telling, and there's a character, and only parts are true. I don't even know if he's in New York, you know, I mean, or he was in Florida. I'm quite sure he wasn't in Iowa, but who knows? You just don't know. It's part of it. You just sort of buy into the world of Norm Augustinus. But Keith began sort of the opposite of, he stepped outside and was going to talk about his father, and then change the episode over to Elliot Smith's XO. An album I've never heard of. I didn't even know it was an album, you know. I didn't even know where the XO came from. Shows how ignorant I am in these things. Ask me about the Beatles, I'll tell you. Ask me about other things, and maybe I don't know. It's just of a different time. But anyway, the point was, there was so much authenticity in his voice. It was so real. It was so carefully crafted. And it was so well thought out. And I'm only talking about the first 3 minutes. He just really planned what he was going to say. And it made me a little bit self-conscious, thinking, wait a minute. So I'm going to get up here. I'm going to give you an hour, but I'm not even going to think about what I'm going to say. I'm just going to turn this thing on and start talking. And, you know, it makes me question, well, what is it I'm doing? Come on now. Shouldn't I really be preparing a little more? Can I really keep getting away with this whatever goes kind of thing? And I guess the answer is, well, I don't know. Let's see what happens. I flicked on the TV this morning, as I did. I just had a wonderful breakfast of just really good cereal. I mix up 4 different kinds of cereal, added blueberries, strawberries, yogurt, milk, piece of really flax bread toasted and a really nice pot of coffee. God, and it's something I look for. And I felt good. I felt, wow, this is kind of nice, you know. Got everything here. And then on TV, on the BBC News, they talked about Bhutan being number one on this happiness scale of living. And they were trying to analyze why. Why are the people in Bhutan, whose average salary is $100 a month, why are they happier than everybody else? And one of the answers was, well, it's family and community and close connections. And there was a balance between, I guess, the spiritual and the material. And I guess, obviously, the material doesn't rank all that high, because I don't think they're all walking around with all the technological gear that most of us over here, yeah, certainly in my listening world, have. It was an entirely different framework for their lives. And it made me, of course, reflect a little more on happiness. And it ties in with what I was thinking about. I was, you know how you can sometimes envy. I try not to. I don't all that much. But envy people who have a whole lot more money just to do anything, go anywhere. Gee, you want to go see a Formula One race? Yeah, get in a plane and go. Like, these are people with exceptional amounts. I'm talking Hollywood money here. But it raises the question, okay, even people who have double, triple, quadruple the money I have, or 10 times, whatever, people who don't have to even think about money, they go somewhere, they get on a plane, they fly somewhere, and they go off to, you know, the Cayman Islands, they go off to Belize, they go anywhere. The only thing that counts is how you feel in every given moment. Like, there's no reason I can't be happier now in this park, in the sunshine, sitting here talking to you, than somebody who's drinking champagne on some beautiful moonlit island in the South Pacific. You know, they can say, wow, look what I've got. But if they're not feeling it inside, if they're not with the person they want to be, if they're not thinking about, you know, their son having stolen their Mercedes and got arrested for DWI or, you know, everything goes on. Life is such a complicated mix. And the simple part is just trying to be accepting of where you are now in that present moment. And my bet is, money is not going to make it any easier. And in fact, it may just have the opposite effect. It may make it a hell of a lot harder, because the richer you are, the more you're just going to be concerned about your investments. And sorry, I got a coffee going here. That's another thing. I woke up this morning and looked at this thermos my wife got me. This, where's the company? Zojirushi. You see it all over. It's a symbol of an elephant. All over Japan. This type of thing. And it was such a nice gift. She wanted to bring back something from Japan on her last trip, and she bought all the stuff for the kids and junk food and everything else and t-shirts for them. And for me, she said, I didn't know what to get you, and I just got you this thermos. And it's really good. It's really good quality, and I like it, and I kind of treasure it. And I'm thinking, yeah, I'm going to bring that on the train with me. And yeah. So little things. The fact that my wife gave me a thermos that I value, that she thought enough about it, I think maybe Kim will appreciate that. That means a whole lot. It's not, you know, a case of vintage cognac. Because, you know, what would that mean? Jeez, yeah, you get a hangover. I don't know. I don't know what I'm getting at here. And that's the thing. I guess I'm just trying to do it in a different way. I'm just hoping that if I just turn this thing on and talk to you, that some truth will come out, some real word, something from that's inside me that I know. Because I think one of my problems is I do know a whole lot. I have had so many experiences. I put myself through life. I've done that. But I don't always know what I've learned. And maybe it's just my nature, being a teacher and so on, that I feel it's just something I want to do. I want to share. I want to share the lessons. I want to share what I've gained. Or maybe I just want to remind myself what I have. It's funny, because last night I was thinking, you know, man, I was talking about music with a faithful listener to the show who I've never met but value very much. And I will be meeting sometime soon if Doug ever has that fucking barbecue. You know who I'm talking about. But he knows a whole lot about the Beatles, turned me on to a certain book about them, and we got into a conversation, as far as you can have a conversation on Twitter goes, about the impact. And I was saying the randomness of what created the Beatles. You know, if this hadn't happened, if somebody hadn't requested a record from the Beatles and Brian Epstein's record shop, if he hadn't gone to the Cavern to see who they were talking about and made the Beatles, because he was a huge part of it, they wouldn't have been famous without Brian Epstein, their manager, who tragically died much too young at a time when you really couldn't come out of the closet very easily. Very shy man, private man. But anyway, if the Beatles hadn't, those things hadn't come into place and they hadn't gelled and they hadn't formed that group and all that music didn't come along, well, somebody might have filled the vacuum, but I don't think so. I don't think there would have been that high. And the question was, what impact would that have on everybody else's life? How would my life be different? I would not be sitting here talking to you on a park bench, talking the way I am now. I don't think I'd be married to the woman I'm married to. I mean, all the things. And of course, that's kind of silly. Yeah, well, if anything changed, you wouldn't have. If your father got a different job, he lived in a different town. Everything. Once you just shift one little piece of the puzzle, everything is just up for grabs. You know, it's all different. But still, they had such a big impact. And his response was along the lines of, yeah, but they always questioned whether they were the cause or a result of this thing. How much of a role did the Beatles play in shaping our lives, our thinking, our values? And how much were they just swept away by the zeitgeist? Is that the word? You know, just the nature of the time, of what was happening? How does everybody connect and interconnect? How do we all touch each other? What little influence do we have, you know? What does it mean that I listen to Norm Augustinus and Keith McNally? If anything, or that, you know, sometimes, I know in the past, they have listened to me and others and you out there. How do we touch each other? What difference does it make in our life? And maybe we just keep coming back to the same point. Oh, how happy are you now? And is it really happiness? No, it's not. I don't think it's, I think I used to think that, but what do you want to be? I want to be happy. But it's happy seems like a funny, kind of silly, kind of smiling, kind of goofy, kind of laughing kind of thing. And I don't think it's happiness. I think it's contentedness. I think it's satisfaction. I think it's acceptance. And it's truly that next level is just where you are now is where you are supposed to be. And I just knew on this Monday morning, dude, I don't call myself dude. I call myself Ken. Ken, you got to get out of the house and you got to go bring your podcasting gear with you and start off an episode. And here I am. I've done it. I've talked to you for 15, 12 minutes, 13 minutes. And I, again, have that feeling, uh-oh, I have just wasted your time. I haven't wasted mine because I'm just loving sitting here bathing in the sunshine. You know, when I pulled up to park the car because I couldn't stop parking the handicap park, a van pulled up beside me. And there was a woman who I knew just visibly, just looking at the person, was of the Islamic faith, and her husband, they often drive vans, by the way, pulled up beside me and had a ticket, and they were waving the ticket, and the ticket, of course, was a parking ticket. And it's a thing people do around City Hall here and government offices. If you've paid for a ticket and it's still got time left, and you see somebody else pull up, you give it to them. It's kind of a nice tradition. And I just thought it was kind of nice that, you know, I opened my door, she rolled down her window and handed me the ticket at her husband's instructions, of course. I don't know. Was there any meaning to that? Was it they would do that to anybody? Or that I would think, oh, gee, even the Muslims do that, you know? No, I know. I don't mean that. The fact that it was a non-issue, hey, we're parkers, we are people who the city is taxing to park our cars, here, we're in this together, that's what it was. It was kind of nice. I was kind of glad, and I took it, and I wanted them to know from the smile on my face that I appreciated it. I wanted that exchange to be a positive exchange. And that is another point I really, really want to hammer on. It is up to us. We talk about our own private satisfaction and happiness and so on, but we've really got a duty to to be nice to the people around us when we can. If somebody's a prick and an asshole, fuck, let them know, you know. I no problem there. But just generally speaking, even if it's a neutral situation, try and turn neutral into positive. Try and give that extra smile, that extra thank you, some kind words. And I tell you this all the time, even if it's just your grocery shopping experience, no matter what it is. And it always stuns me, the number of people. And maybe it's because they're shy or insecure, who just want to get through the transaction but don't want to have any interpersonal contact. Well, fuck, use a banking machine, you know. When you go to Canadian Tire, just use the automated checkout, although they never work and you always have to call someone over, and you end up having much more of a human exchange than you would if you'd gone through the regular cashier who's talking on the phone to her boyfriend and not even paying attention. That's Canadian Tire for you. Anyway, here we are, and I guess it turns out I really, really thought I had something to say, and this gets me back to the beginning when Keith McNally actually mapped out what he wanted to talk to you about, and I think, no, dude, you can just get away with just turning this on and just talking, because that's kind of what feels good, and this is kind of your morning mantra, and this is my zen, this is what I do, this is what makes me feel good, and that's why I'm just pouring out these words without really a care for what I'm sharing, and that's not very nice of me. So I'm going to stop it right there, and if I think of something else, I know I did want to talk about War and Peace. I did want to talk about some serious issues in the news and other things, and I think I've lost it by now. I think it's just not there, and instead you get this. So thank you for being patient, and let me give you a tune to make you a little bit happier. Thank you, bye. Yeah, I just wanted to add something. As I was sitting there talking to you, a guy walked by very quickly in uniform with a parking meter ticket machine. And had I not, here he goes now in his car, had I not been given that ticket by that couple, I very well might have been ticketed and my entire day would have been changed. Had that couple not said, because I was going to buy one. Hey, I'm just sitting over here in the park. I'm not going to pay any fucking parking ticket. And sure enough, he just stormed past my car, looked at the windshield, saw the time. I still had 3 minutes left on it. So that little exchange, that person handing me something, they don't know it, but it could very well have had a huge impact. Because if I had got this fucking parking ticket, I would have been so pissed off. And who knows how the ripples that that would have had on the rest of my day. And it was kind of my point. Like, I get home and I'm in a bad mood suddenly and pick a fight with my wife or this or that or whatever, or my son. All the different things that could go on. You know, just, you know, decide I'm not going to buy something because I've just had to spend 20, 30 bucks on a ticket. Everything just had that impact. Anyway, I know you're saying, it doesn't mean anything, dude. Shut the fuck up. But it just seemed kind of an affirmation about that little act of kindness from them and my gratitude and the fact that, hey, it did have an impact. It did have significance. It did mean something. All right. Got to get back to Keith McNally.
And to make it a little different, instead of just playing the album versions of all the songs, I found live versions or early demos.
All right. We'll hear that a little later on. And carry on. Take care. Bye for now. So. I could not walk at all.
scalpel blade laid beside my silver spoon. Some girls wander by mistake into the mess that scalpels make. Are you the teachers of my heart? We teach all hearts to break. One morning I woke up alone, the hospital and the nurses gone. Have I carved enough, my lord? Child, you are a bone. I ate and ate and ate. No, I didn't miss a plate. Well, how much do these suppers cost? We'll take it out in hate. I spend my hatred every place, on every work, on every face. Someone gave me wishes and I wish for embrace. Several girls embraced me and I was embraced by men. Is my passion perfect? No, do it. I was handsome, I was strong, I knew the words of every song. Did my singing please you? No, the words you sang were wrong. Who is it whom I address? Who takes down what I confess? Are you the teachers of my heart? We teach your hearts to rest. Teachers, all my lessons done, I cannot do another one. They laughed and laughed and said, well, child, all your lessons done.
Don't you just hate that? When you give what you know is a really, really good little story, and you look down to see how long I've been going, and it's registering 00000. Uh-oh. Forgot to push that button again to make it record. So you didn't get that story of the spider thread hanging above my head and how that connected to sitting on the corner of a pyramid in Mexico in Palenque and high on mushrooms and being driven off by, or trying to be driven off by, flies and bees and people's voices and not letting any of it get in my way because I was where I was supposed to be. And unfortunately, it's just not in me to bring that whole story back to life the way it was when I just told it to you only moments ago, because the moment is past. So I'll just have to be content to say, well, I entertained myself. I'm really sorry I didn't get to share it with you, but I guess the point of my story was you just accept things for what they are, and damn it, it was really good. I know that. Now, the ones you lose are always good, but this one was. I nailed it. I really nailed it, and now it's nowhere. It's in the passing air. It's gone. But I guess that doesn't stop me from enjoying the warmth of the sunshine beating down on my face, as I said earlier. And I guess now that that's out of me and I've shot my wad, I'll stop for now and come back to you if I get another urge. Sorry about that.
walk up and down outside the wall. Some hand in hand, and some gathered together in bands. The bleeding hearts and the artists make their stand. And when they've given you their all, some stagger and fall. After all, it's not easy. Banging your heart against some mad bugger's wall.
Yeah, it's me again, still here by the water in Bluffers Park, or actually beachside. And I've just finished, finally, after a couple of weeks, the passage in This Is It called Beat Zen, Square Zen, Zen. It's beautiful, and it's, I don't know, it's taken me this long, at this age, to actually understand. Like, I had to reread so much of this and read it again. But I guess I'm just in the place with Elliot Smith in the background on my iPod and reading this slowly, that it all comes to a beautiful conclusion. I'm going to read just a little bit from it. Really, he's comparing the difference between Beat Zen, which is this movement, right, from the 50s of just everything modern and letting go and freestyle and without structure, and people being attracted to the religions of the East, rejecting American world view and consumerism, and trying to find a new identity, a new way of looking at life. And some people became, I was going to use the word hipsters, but Alan Watts has sort of seen them with a slightly cynical view that maybe they are just trying a little too hard to be different, to be cool. And he compares that to Square Zen, those people who think, yes, they've got to run off to a Japanese monastery and follow one particular school and study that way for years on end. And that also was false. It's sort of like people, he mentions about trying to copy the ancient arts of Japan. The student of sumi painting, calligraphy, haiku poetry, or tea ceremony can therefore get trapped in tiresomely repetitious affectations of styles, varied only in increasingly allusions to the work of the past. When this comes to the point of imitating the old master's happy accidents in such a way that primitive and rough effects are produced by the utmost practice and deliberation, the whole thing becomes so painful that even the wildest excesses of Beat Zen art look refreshing. In other words, there are phonies out there trying to imitate something by even planning on putting in, you know, in Japanese beauty, there has to be an element of something that's not quite perfect to make an object truly perfect. There has to be an accident, a crack, a break, a misshape or something. And when you actually add those in deliberately on purpose to imitate, you're just not getting it. Further on in the passage, the old Chinese Zen masters were steeped in Taoism. They saw nature in its total interrelatedness, and saw that every creature and every experience is in accord with the Tao of nature, just as it is. This enabled them to accept themselves as they were, moment by moment, without the least need to justify anything. Oh, how I love that. On the contrary, they didn't brag about it and set themselves apart as rather special. On the contrary, their Zen was wuxi, which means approximately nothing special or no fuss. But Zen is fuss when it is mixed up with bohemian affectations, and fuss when it is imagined that the only proper way to find it is to run off to a monastery in Japan or to do special exercises in the lotus position for 5 hours a day. So, again, he's making fun of both schools. But then he goes on to say that Actually, having said that, I would like to say something for all Zen fussers, beat or square. Fuss is all right, too. If you're hung on Zen, there's no need to try to pretend that you are not. If you really want to spend some years in a Japanese monastery, there's no earthly reason why you shouldn't. Or if you want to spend your time hopping freight trains and digging Charlie Parker, it's a free country. And the final passage, a little quote from a Chinese poem. In the landscape of spring, there is neither better nor worse. The flowering branches grow naturally, some long, some short. And that's how the chapter, how the essay ends. And as I sit here in this absolutely perfect location, I feel almost like I could have burst like a ripe grape just then. I am not being affectatious. This is beautiful. This is wonderful. This is this now of the sun, the wind, the water. It's just, and it's spring. It's just so, so, so perfect. Just now, just is. And I feel for the hipsters out there today who just try so hard to be cool, to fit, to somehow have the right thing, wear the right thing, say the right thing, listen to the right thing, smoke the right thing. It just let it go and try the hardest trick of all. Be yourself. Whew. I'm going to end there. Man, I am glowing, and I thank Alan Watts. I thank you, God, for this. And what's so funny is that I have this book, but Barnacle Bill sent it to me with all the letters that I had sent off to our friend Peter, whose ashes are going to be scattered sometime this month. And I'm going to bring it back. I'm going to read more of it on the train, and I'm going to give it to Adam, because I really think Adam needs to read this. So, there you go. This is it. Bye for now, boys and girls. Ooh, ooh. Life is good. Yep. Enough said.
And tell me how you feel. Tell me love is real. Mm-hmm. Words of love you whisper soft and true. Darling, I love you.
I had made a few notes. I decided after I was talking to before. Oh, God. I had allergies. Anyway, I made a few notes. I decided after that last bit. Remember I was talking about trying to be spontaneous and other people prepare. And so I jotted a few things down that I wanted to talk about. Didn't say what I was going to say, but just the topics, right? And the first one I've got here is belief systems that were taught. and how we have to challenge them. And that's just a given. It's something I try and teach my students, that whoever brings you up, wherever you're brought up, comes with a lot of baggage. It's just that your parents teach, okay, this is what we believe is right, whether it's their church, their political affiliation, their approach to business, their values. You know, that's natural. That's what parents do. You have to pass it on. And then your school system does as well, you know, to make you good citizens and your country. Now, you know all this stuff. But what happens is a lot of people just buy into it, you know, and it takes a long time for some people to wake up and actually challenge the thinking. And I think, again, this was what was so easy and so enjoyable about the 60s, and that was sort of handed to us. Whoa, overthrow everything, they say, because they're liars. And this is especially true when you look at the American political system. What, you know, this trying to pass off this war in Vietnam as the way to stop this spread of communism, that it had to be done. And you look at who are those assholes who are in power? Who stands to benefit from this? Why are young people, college students, being drafted to go off and fight in this war? Why is this country at war anyway? Like, whoa, the French pulled out? Like, whoa, is that really going to be the case? So it was clear. It was easy to get on one side or the other, you know, be with the Nixon and for the war and stopping the spread of this evil called communism, or just say, wait a minute now, that may not be true what you're telling us. So I think people of my generation, it was a little easier to challenge, and I like to think it's happening now too. I think I see it in my sons of just not taking things for granted, but from a lot of other countries, I think just people in general want to, you know, it's easier to take the road that's already been prepared for you, you know. Okay, here, study these, get the certificate, earn this money, buy these things, and this is the path that you should embark on, because this is what leads to a happy life. God, you know, I thought there was something important in there, and it didn't seem the least bit important at all, but I guess it's tied into a movie that I watched. A Netflix film that I watched on my iPad called the American War on Drugs. And it was something about, God, was it White Power or The Last White Hope or something like that? It's a weird one. And it just showed the hypocrisy of this war on drugs and the insanity of it. And again, I guess I'm preaching to the converted, because I think anybody listening to Dixon Jane's show has probably a much more enlightened view about drugs than maybe the average Republican. It just boggles my mind to think that this war on drugs has gone on for, what, 40, 50 fucking years? And it's clearly a drain on resources. It's rewarding corrupt people, whether they're criminals or the industries that stand to benefit, or the people who build the prisons, you know, locking up people for the harmless drugs that they're doing. It's a medical issue. It's a social issue. Oh. Again, why do I think this is important to share to you? You already know, but I guess sometimes I have to get my head out of the sand and go, wait a minute, there's a whole lot of other people around there who continue to enforce these drugs or have this belief that all drugs are bad and don't even bother to separate one from another, and psychedelics from marijuana to non-addictive to the dirty, nasty business. This of crack cocaine, this showed it was almost like a conspiracy to lock up the blacks, you know, just to penalize very heavily by providing this drug. And it was true that the Americans wanted to support the Contras, you know, the good guys. They weren't terrorists. They were the Contras fighting an elected socialist government, I guess, in Nicaragua. And therefore, they just allowed people to take control of the drug trade, and they could sell this and take the money from that, let it get into America by the plane load, and take the money made from this and buy weapons, so bypassing Congress and so on. And this is documented. I mean, the book that I read in university, The Politics of Heroin in Southeast Asia, showed the same thing happening post-war. You know, give the ports to the mafia, the gangsters, and let them control what goes in and out of the ports as long as they keep the communists out, in France in particular and in other places. Here's what I'm boiling down to, okay? I'm not doing a very good job on this. That's why I never do fucking notes. I work far better when I'm spontaneous. I really do. Fuck the notes. I tried. You saw me. You heard me. But the point I do want to make, damn it, did I just lose it? It's amazing how, yes, we used to believe Americans were the good guys, the American government. These are the people we want to be allied with. These are the guys who are right. Everybody else is wrong. And my God, how wrong we are. And I'm sorry, like, I'm almost paranoid now, thinking, ooh, who's gonna, nobody cares about the Dixon Jane show and this harmless old guy, the Scarborough dude. But I will say, fucking America, goddammit, you frighten me. And the fact when I look at the kind of people who run your country, the corruptness, the hypocrisy, the greed, the evil, it just scares the shit out of me. It's like this white clique is going to run this country and keep the power. And there'll be people at the top, and we don't give a fuck about the people at the bottom. And I don't think it's ever going to be possible to actually change that country and make it good again. I'm sorry to American listeners, you as individuals, wow, what fine, nice people out there. You ain't the problem. But my God, that fucking system of your government and the belief system that's been propped up and held in place is so corrupt and so wrong, and you've done such an amazing job up until recently of convincing so many people that you were right and you were the hope. And it's sad, sad, sad to know that this is not fucking true. Just fucking come clean. Say, we have run our country to shit. We have poverty. We have fat people. We have ignorant people. We have a piss-poor education system, except for the elite and those at the top. We really have created this class society where you have a very rich elite and you have the masses down below that the elite just don't give a fuck about. And it's wrong. It's just fucking wrong. And I don't want blood flowing through the streets. But God damn it, how are we ever going to change that? Because we're following fast on your heels with the likes of Stephen Harper leading us down this path for all the fucking wrong values and the good things in life and the care and the kindness. Oh, my God. So, I don't know, somebody here, you can call bullshit on me for this, saying, oh, yeah, that's just the party line, man. You're just echoing back what you just criticized, and maybe a little bit of that is true. My wife is in the hospital today for a little procedure, out within 2 hours, amazing, and just, you know, wow, credit to this wonderful medical system we have that we can still, right now, afford and keep in place, and the good, kind people out there. So, I'm not saying that the majority of the people aren't good, almost everywhere. The majority of people are good, but we've just been buggered around by a lot of people with completely different set of values and motivated by greed and power. And that's wrong, and that's got to be changed, and I don't know how we're ever going to change it. All right, so I guess I'm going to stop right there. Boy, that was probably not worth your time or mine, but I'm not going to, fuck these notes, I'm not doing notes again, fuck that. I'm going right back, I tried it, I'm going right back to the old, turn it on, let's see what pops out, because trying to sort of come up with something you thought was important at one time might not be important now, right? So the way this works is it's what bubbles to the surface now. I will have to say that I took the day off. First of all, to get my wife to and from the hospital, and I haven't seen her high for a very long time. And after the drugs they gave her, she was in a very happy space. It was really nice to see the staff, the nurse referred to it, says, oh, we call that the Michael Jackson drug. I didn't quite get the reference other than people just seemed pretty happy afterwards. And it was cute. It was very, very endearing and cute. And then we came home, and she's able to eat again, and we watched Sayonara, 1957 Marlon Brando, and it was kind of neat, and it was kind of neat because it was a story of, you know, Americans and set during the Korean War. We got a theme going here, boys and girls. set during the Korean War. Marlon Brando was scheduled to marry the general's daughter, beautiful woman, and a domineering mother who just wants him to be with the right people. And he's led all his life as this character to please his father, who was also a general, and he's just going to do the right thing and marry this girl. And she's getting the feeling that, God, maybe he doesn't want to marry, and he's a well-known flyer, pilot, and he's really happier back in Korea flying bombing missions. And anyway, they transfer him over to Japan, where the general's stationed and where he can meet this surprise, his girlfriend, his fiance. And of course, in the course of the movie, a good friend of his marries a Japanese woman, and it just exposes the prejudice. The Americans don't want them to. We've had 10,000 of our troops, and this doesn't look good, and they can't marry them. They can't bring them back to America. It was against the law if you're in the military anyway. And it did a nice job of sort of talking about the prejudice. And what I was pointing out to my wife and son, because we all watched it together, was you have to remember, this is in 57, Marlon Brando, big star, set. If you're watching this movie in a small town and all you've known about the Japanese were the Japs in World War II, which wasn't that long ago, right? This is 57, that was 45, and all the propaganda, suddenly this movie is portraying them in a new light. Gee, they really aren't so bad, you know? And well, that's kind of neat, and their culture, it's full of kabuki and everything else, and these beautiful little houses, and one very kind woman who the guy marries, who tries to have eye surgery to make her eyes look more American, and of course, the husband goes crazy. Don't you ever do that. You're beautiful just as you are. And all these scenes. If you haven't seen the movie, it's corny and it's predictable. My son said it's just a ripoff of Shakespeare, because kind of was in parts. But I kind of like the way that it tried to explore the whole issue of prejudice and bias and the difference between the races. And of course, Marlon Brando proposes to this beautiful woman, and don't want to give it away, but I just have, because you're new, who gives a shit? You've already seen it, or you're never going to see it, doesn't matter. Proposes to her and says, we'll have, Jesus, you bought our children, will be half Japanese, half American. And of course, my son is sitting between my wife and I, half Japanese, half Canadian. And I guess what I'm seeing, in a very awkward and terribly clumsy way, it was kind of special, the three of us sitting on the sofa on a day when my wife had just come back, and we were just delighted to know she's in great health and there are no problems. And here's my 20-year-old son sitting between us, a product of this marriage. And it was kind of nice to sort of share that in a kind of a tender, at times slightly uncomfortable way, because it was very close to home. A little bit of prejudice there, and a little bit of the difficulty sometimes that are faced with marrying between races. So, I guess you're going to have to read between the lines. I don't know. I guess I'm going to end right now. Let the seagulls have the last word. Oh, I love that. I'm here at Bluffers Park at the beach. I just want to come out and get this off. Try this little experiment of making some notes so I would give you a more focused podcast, and I'm kind of pleased to say, no, it doesn't work that way. We're going back to the old system. Turn it on, start talking, see what comes out. If you don't like it, fuck you, or I just don't even include the clip. Thank you. Talk to you later. Bye for now. And now I get back to my buddy, yours and mine, Norm Augustinus.
So far, truly, the best time I've had was at the comedy club when I backhanded that woman. And I'm going to tell you, if you're a woman, please don't be offended. She came at me with her nails. What was I supposed to do? Stand there like an idiot? I've been abused all my life. Grown up on me. Don't believe what I see.
Yeah. Ooh, lovely. Lots of little birdies around today. It's a glorious day. It's a Good Friday, 2012. And, of course, I'm in Bluffers Park. It's sunny, warm. Well, cool, but just feels good. It's spring. The weeping willow that I'm sitting right beside is just, you know, how just suddenly these green shoots just sprout out seemingly overnight from... They're bare all winter, and then just green just shoots out so incredibly fast. It's really, really lovely. Gosh, it's beautiful. This is such a fine spot. I'm sorry to go on about it, but my goodness. It's such a bonus to have a place you can come to and just feel, oh, I don't know, comfortable, happy, and admiring the scenery. I'm facing right into the sun, so I catch the reflection, the warmth off the water, too. It's beautiful. Anyway, I think this is going to be the last clip in this particular podcast, but I know I've got far more to say than I'm going to be able to fit in. Where to start? Last class, I always feel, I think I've told you when I teach my students, we've got a textbook, we've got a curriculum. I almost always just abandon the curriculum. I try and tell them, okay, listen, other classes might be doing this, so you want to be reviewing these chapters and, you know, the modals could and would and should and things like that. But yeah, it's kind of boring. I'll tell them it's boring. And then just try and get their interest. Sometimes I'll just sit in the table. It's a small group on last class. And I showed them the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and got into a discussion about that. Now, it, you know, in itself, I said, you'll never go through this, all these things, but this is what it's about and when it happened. And I pointed out that it was created the year I was born, 1948. So I have this affinity to it, this special feeling. Yeah, this is what we want in a world. And I talked about World War I and World War II. And then somebody had made a very creative little presentation of an animated show of just bouncing the titles, you know, No Man Shall Be a Slave to Any Other and stuff like that. And had them watch that for 3 minutes, and we talked about it after. And, of course, the consensus was, that's great, but it'll never happen, you know. People don't do that. The people with power, and in particular, fingers are being pointed at America. A country with this much power will dominate other countries, and the rich will keep the poor under their thumb. And it's so sad, but true. So that's the kind of tangent I like to get off onto. And I think, you know, by the end of the class, something like that is more important than, okay, let's do one more exercise. Should you say must or have to or had better, you know, in this section? You got to do that too, but man, it's hard. I just try to let my spirit flow. And there are certain constraints, you know, you got to hold back and like, when there are papers to mark, you have to eventually mark those papers by a set deadline. But meanwhile, what I try and do is find some time for what I feel has to be done, and then, bam, open up as much free time as possible to get onto other topics and just have discussions. I had a wonderful discussion with a man from Afghanistan about its future, and he was very much in support of the Americans and Canadians being there to help build schools and keep the Taliban at bay. So, anyway, I kind of love my teaching job. Damn it, I'm not going to get on to the things I did want to talk about. Another argument with number two son about, oh, just the whole thing of the Holocaust and where he gets his information and can you trust? I guess, as my wife was telling me kindly, listen, conspiracy theories are far more interesting than the books you claim to have read and the textbooks. And when you're young, that's more interesting. And my son wants me, well, check this out. You should read this. And I'm saying, well, where the hell did they get that information? And how do you know? And he's sort of asserting something as a fact because he has read it. And we end up having a big three-way fight at the dinner table. It's actually quite bad. I'm guilty. I think we got into the fact that Germans were well aware of what the Nazis, what had been done, you know, during the time of the Nazis having power, and they don't want it to happen again, and they're not denying the truth, unlike Japan, whose students don't know what role Japan had. And, of course, that just set my wife off, and then my son got in about some other propaganda and who's behind this. And it became a three-way battle over the dinner table. It was a really dumb move, and I think I'm guilty or responsible for that, stirring that old damn thing up. It all came down because my grandfather, I've been tracking down records, I've been watching documentaries, this is what it boils down to. They had some very good documentaries on World War I, on the Battle of Vimy Ridge, and the role of the Canadian Expeditionary Force, CEF. And that just sort of got me going, saying, my grandfather served in that. And I went back online and tracked down what do I have in my family tree software about my grandfather. And it had the ship he sailed on. And it turns out he signed up in 1915. And I was able to actually find the document going through the Canadian National Archives. I see the paper with his signature, Percy Luscombe, signing up. It's there. It's amazing. You know, here it is on my computer screen. What? That was my grandfather. That's 100 years old almost. His signature joining the forces, the Victoria Fusiliers of the 88th Battalion, which, of course, you know, was put in as reinforcements to join other forces and serve in France. And he sailed on the Olympic, which, as you know, was the elder sister ship to the Titanic. It was the first one. The Titanic was the second. And after the sinking of the Titanic, 100 years ago this month, the Olympic was sent back in to be double-hulled and reinforced and have adequate lifeboats on, and served as a troop carrier. And 6,000 soldiers at a time sailed from Halifax to Liverpool on the Olympic, and my grandfather was one of them. I have the sailing dates, you know, and documents about it, pictures of this ship that you can find online. So I guess my feeling was, oh, I'm running out of time. I'm going to have to pick this up next time, because I got so caught up in the fact that this is real. You know, that argument I had with the family at the dinner table, sort of in the abstract of what we read in history books, that's what it came down to. Where do you get your information? This is real information. I know from my mother that my father and grandfather served in World War II, and then, or World War I, and then finding these online documents, you know, with his name and piecing together the family history and what happened when he came back in 1919 on the Regina, you know, sailing to Montreal and beginning a new life, and of course never being quite the same after that war, that there was a living link to World War I through me, through my grandfather, who I knew and loved and wished I had more of. And then to realize that when I go, there'll be no connection anymore. Nobody will know my grandfather. There is no more living connection. It just gets cut off with each generation. You know, you got 2-3 generations if you're lucky, and they don't. So my children will never know, you know, my mother's father. And it just, you know, there was something sad about it, and something kind of important that I hang on to. And maybe that's the purpose of another podcast, a family history type thing. I don't know. All I know is I've run out of time for this baby, and I'll maybe just, I don't know, I mean, I could turn this around and say, hey, hang on there, this is the beginning of another one. I don't know what to do with it, because I'm not done with that topic yet, World War I and my grandfather. But I'll end this clip here and see what we can do, see if we can patch together this episode while I go back home and mark exams. Thank you for listening to the Dixon James Podcast, and I really do hope you come back for more, because I'll be here for sure. Take care, boys and girls. Bye for now.